Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News. And today, Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel. And I'm Phil Kogan. Hello, May.
Hi, how are you?
What are we talking about today in summary?
In summary, the bulk of the hour will be spent on agent provocateurs, the discussion of who they are, what they are, why we have them, what effects they make upon our society. Dialogue assassination has to do with the murder of Robert Kennedy, President John Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, and other political people who could effect changes in our society who were assassinated in order to halt the changes they would make. And in order to continue the process of taking more power and going into a fascist state, you need provocateurs. The people do not stir up the riots and the problems that the leaders need in order to prove the existence, their existence, or the need for more TAC forces or squads and a tighter police state. They place agent provocateurs into positions to stir up trouble. And we'll go through, as much as we have time, a long list of well-known, they're well-known now, provocateurs who have surfaced and discuss the role that they have played to get us into the political state that we're in today. I brought in a book before we start. It's by Clarence Lasby. It just came out in December 1971, just a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And I'm going to give the title of this book every week that I'm on the air and everywhere that I speak publicly. It's called Project Paperclip. I referred to it on one show before, and I'm going to refer to it constantly. Project Paperclip is put out by Athenaeum Press, and I've asked Thunderbird to carry those books. I'm going to every bookstore in town. I want them to buy this book and have it out. When people want to know which is the most important book to read on John Kennedy or the political assassination, it's a toss-up because there's so many good books out on the evidence that there was a conspiracy. But Project Paperclip is the story of the process of bringing over Nazis after World War II and placing them into defense industries, educational institutions. And this group of men were not held as war prisoners. They were brought into this country. And because so much of my work of political assassinations involves Nazis, people that Lee Harvey Oswald was with, like Albert Osborne, who sat on the bus with Oswald going to Mexico City, was arrested in 42 in Tennessee for burning the American flag for being a Nazi. George de Morenschild, Oswald's best friend, was George von Morenschild, and he was apprehended, followed by the FBI down to Corpus Christi near Mexico on the Gulf for drawing installations, apprehended for being a Nazi, praising Himmler at the Petroleum Club in Dallas. My research, I'll go on and on, do a show, and I'm writing an article on Nazis involved in the assassination. General Dornberger, the Nazi general, was vice president and manager of Bell Aerospace. He still is in the Fort Worth area of Texas. It's one of the largest defense contractors we have. Dornberger brought over Wernher von Braun, and those two men ran the rocket factories in Germany, the Nazi rocket factories for Hitler. And Michael Payne, one of the designers for helicopters at Bell Aerospace that Dornberger managed. That was the host for Lee and Marina Oswald. They stayed at the home of Michael and Ruth Payne. Those were the people that took Marina Oswald to New Orleans, that Marina lived with them while Lee went down there to get a job in New Orleans. She lived 3 weeks. When Lee Oswald returned, he goes right to their home. He went to the home of Michael and Ruth Payne, third-generation Harvard student, nuclear physicist, employed by Dornberger. Now, one of the things I will bring up about this book many times on the show is that one of the conditions of bringing these Nazis over was that if they were involved in any war crimes, they would be deported.
Now, before you go any further, I've been trying to get this in. Who brought the Nazis over and why?
Well, a lot of persons believed in our State Department, and particularly Navy intelligence, certain men felt if we have these minds, these rocket scientists and these missile men, it will help us win the war against Japan. But there was a toss-up and a real serious question, did they really mean to go after Russia in the Cold War? Because the Nazi mentality said if we rule the Earth from space, we control the entire world. And they wanted to continue this pure Aryan philosophy, certain people in our State Department and in the armed services, like the idea of controlling the world and never being caught again in a battle like they had just gone through. And they brought these men over to combine their energies with our money and their knowledge, and the hundreds of them were brought into this country. And this book is about the controversy about how many should have been allowed here, what we should do with them, and the problem was, will they bring their idea of the super race and the master race to our country? And when the president just gave his State of the Union message about the money for missiles and aerospace and the supersonic will go through and the space shuttle thing is coming up now, the defense industry, they say our economy would be jobless if we didn't put money into space. There are many, many ways to spend our tax money that would benefit the nation. And this racist philosophy is perpetuated through these Nazis who have high positions in our government.
They still are in high places in the government?
Yes, they are. And when they went into the missile factories and found the slave labor and the bones piled up of these factories where Dornberger and von Braun worked, those men should have been deported. The condition was that if they were involved in war crimes, they couldn't stay. But they've become American heroes and very wealthy in our country.
Is there proof that they were involved, or that they, or is it just the fact that they worked where these things went on and they weren't responsible for them?
Well, they knew. There is proof that the missile factories worked on slave labor, and then when the troops came in, the bones were piled up, hundreds of thousands upon hundreds of thousands. I'll go into this book for one show if you want, but I don't want, if somebody hears one show and misses another, I want them to get this book because it's new, and I want them to carry it, and then they'll understand where their tax dollar is going this year.
Okay, that's Project Paperclip, German Scientists and the Cold War. It's by Clarence G. Lasby.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's published by the Athenaeum Press. So
now, the death penalty, the California Supreme Court ruled out the death penalty, and the people of California, the people in Carmel, Santa Cruz, Salinas, who hear me, I want to tell you that I think you should sit down and take time and write a letter and tell the court that you appreciate this decision, because the governor of this state, Ronald Reagan, and the Attorney General, Evel Younger, want to go challenge the legality of this, and they say it's against the wishes of the people, and I don't believe that. I think you shouldn't sit back quietly. If you appreciate the position they took this week and the brilliance with which they stated their opinion, you should write a letter of appreciation and not take so much for granted in this country. It was a major decision. Now, in terms of political assassinations, it was a good position, and I'm glad to see the officials in Sacramento screaming and yelling, because Charles Manson, Sirhan Sirhan, and John Fraser did not kill the persons they were alleged to have killed. And
that's a pretty heavy statement.
I make it every week.
That's been made several times before.
That's right. I make it all the time. And I think these men should be allowed to live and be separated where persons, researchers, could interview them and really get the facts of the case. They should be offered some kind of immunity for telling us what happened, like Valachi of the Mafia was offered a penthouse in a prison in Washington.
Do you think they really know?
Yes. Yeah, I know. Each one of them individually has said when the truth comes out, it will shake the whole system of this country. Manson has said it individually. Sirhan has said it. John Fraser has not said that much, but there's much evidence that there were many people up at the home of Dr. Oda. Now, this week when the death penalty was ruled illegal, Mr. Peter Chang in Santa Cruz, the district attorney up there, made an interesting comment. He stated that he was concerned that the abolition of the death penalty would result in more killings of small businessmen, end quote. I don't know what he's talking about. I don't think anyone on death row killed a small businessman. And we know that Dr. Oda was not a small businessman. He was a very, very wealthy man who arrived poor into the Santa Cruz area, made a fabulous fortune, and sent seven brothers to medical school, had all of his children in private school. He made a extreme amount of wealth in a short time, and a lot of people are doing research into the Santa Cruz area, the drug traffic and the mafia, the syndicate, and at the time the trial was over, some woman yelled when John Fraser got the verdict of death penalty, a woman in the court yelled, Don't the people of California know a syndicate killing when they see one? And I tried to reach the attorneys for John Fraser. They took it lightly, walked out of the room, didn't interview this woman. But the people in Santa Cruz are doing research on District Attorney Peter Chang in that case. And it was interesting how he turned it around about killing small businessmen, because that has nothing to do with why John Fraser was in prison. And then San Jose Police Chief Robert Murphy came forward and said the death penalty was a definite deterrent in certain types of crime, and he cited the willful killing of an on-duty policeman or prisoner on guard. And San Jose Police Chief Robert Murphy was the man who defended his policeman, one cop in uniform, Officer Woolley, and two plainclothesmen when they shot John Smith coming home at 4 in the morning. This case has been going on and just was ended. Officer Woolley was relieved of any penalties at all. And Chief of Police Murphy said, right the day that Officer Woolley was arrested, Murphy said, I know he's innocent. He did this in self-defense. And that particular policeman had put mace in this gentleman's two eyes on a traffic violation, had sent dog out of the car to bite him, hit him on the head with a flashlight. He had multiple scars on his body, and then he shot him from about 6 feet away and just blew him to pieces. And the man had no weapon on him of any kind. He had a traffic violation. So this man, if John Smith had lived and defended himself and gotten hold of Officer Woolley just in self-defense, then the chief of police said, well, that's death penalty for the man. The officer can mace you, throw out the dog, beat you up. And if you hit back and defend yourself, you get the death penalty for killing a policeman. Because in the confrontation, John Smith said to him, I'm going to sue you. And this is one of the off-duty policemen testified to this, and he said, not if you're dead, you're not going to. And he killed him. And so I think it's interesting that the interview after the decision on the death penalty by Chief of Police Murphy comes out. Also, I might just say in passing that before the verdict was in of whether Officer Woolley was guilty or not of manslaughter, before the verdict was in while the jury was still out, Evel Young, or the Attorney General of the state, promoted Police Chief Murphy to a part of his special California tax squad. And he had commended this man for the job he had done. Now, we're going on briefly for a discussion of dialogue with Bert Talcott, the representative.
Now why don't you explain how that came about, why it came about, and at whose urging?
Well, what happened, you were in on this with me. We had been on the air since late June, and about September there was a call from Washington, wasn't there, about a program on political assassinations. They called the station.
Actually, from Salinas, from his field
office. Oh, from Salinas, yeah.
His field office.
He had called out there and said, what is going on? They'd received letters in Washington from people listening to the show.
Right.
And my answer at the time was that Representative Talcott didn't know what to answer to people who were saying, open the archives, or what is the story of the conspiracies. So my message through the field office here was that every research had been put down by public officials continuously, and what they said, we were misfits or loners or we made a lot of money off the assassination. And I said, none of these adjectives fit me or my research. I've spent 8 years cross-filing the government documents, the FBI reports, the witness testimony, and that if Mr. Talcott wishes to answer any of these people, all he can say is, I'm unfamiliar with the subject until I meet with Mae Brussel, because I don't know what material she has. Well, we had telephone conversations going back and forth between Mr. Talcott and the field office, and then he set a date for February and came to my home with Mr. Cody, and he came into my library, and there I have 109 books on the political assassination of John Kennedy, books on the Chappaquiddick acts of Ted Kennedy, the death of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and about 100 books on espionage systems and State Department papers, and 300 notebooks of newspaper clippings on all the political murders, and about 80 books of cross-filing of witness testimony. And he sat in my study, which I call my little archives. That's my National Archives. And he looked around, and he had no intention of wanting to know how I came to the conclusion of a conspiracy. I have to say this, he came out there as a representative of the member of Congress, and I feel that he didn't show any curiosity in anything I had to say. He had an answer for everything, and I didn't mind, because I had an answer for his answer. And he looked at all the books, and he said, well, there's so many different opinions. How can you come to one opinion? And I said, well, I choose the books to study if you want to understand the problem. take the books that have a volume number, a page number, where you can go back to the what the witness said, or like on the rifle ownership of Oswald. If you want to know how he got the gun, how he received it, where it came, did he really own it, you read all the people that were involved in handling that rifle before it ended up in the depository, the witnesses that are called, and the FBI reports, the Dallas police reports. And I told them I stick with books that have a volume number and a page number that I can look up the accuracy, and they're not just theories. I want to know all of that. His feeling was, well, there's so many books that you can't trust any of them. And when I explained how I do my research, he said, well, what is witness testimony? That's just one person's word after another. It's under oath. He says, well, what does that mean? I said, well, then if they're perjured, if they lied, if they say things, if there's 552 witnesses and they lied because the FBI reports are different than what they said, they should be arrested for perjury. They're under oath. He said, well, it doesn't matter. He says, what is the Warren Commission? It's just a group of men pointing together. It's not really a set fact. It's just a group of people. Well, you had this when you had the commission on sex and pornography or violence. If the president doesn't like it, he says, well, I just picked the wrong commission. That's not necessarily true. But here's a historic thing, whether to find who killed the president, because you're talking about the exchange of power, Phil. You know, and you're talking about a man was elected by the majority, and he's killed. And you want to know if he was killed so that other decisions could take priority in the foreign policy, like recognizing the Dominican Republic, escalating the war in Vietnam. Even though Kennedy had ground troops or observers in Vietnam, that is no indication or proof that he intended to escalate, because there isn't one document available that he intended to escalate. So he said, well, what does that mean? So they perjured themselves. It's just a commission. And I said, well, let's get down to solving a crime. Let's be specific. The researchers want to go in the archives and see the x-rays of John Kennedy. He says, that's ridiculous. I said, well, you sent a government witness, Dr. Lattimore, who's a urologist. And we want somebody who knows x-rays to tell us how many holes are in this body. So then Representative Talcott says, well, when I was in the service in my platoon, he says, I had a gynecologist. Well, I could have made some really dirty remarks or fresh remarks if I wanted to, apropos of that. But we're not talking about military service. We're talking about an autopsy done on the President of the United States. He doesn't have to have a gynecologist or a urologist in there. I mean, it's not a battle scene or an emergency. You know, if James Reston is in China and has appendicitis, they use acupuncture. But if he's in New York, he'd use another method. And there are other methods of deciding what those x-rays say about John Kennedy. And I said, why don't you just open up the archives and let people who have done research, 8 years or more, is that a fair amount of years? The original researchers, the group of us who worked 8 years or more, examine some of this evidence, and then we will be quiet forever. He says, oh, no, you won't. Then you'll talk about a conspiracy. And I said, yeah, that's right, we will. You know, let us see it and show that we're wrong and end all this talk. He says, no, we couldn't do that because then you'd find something that's a conspiracy. So you can't go into the National Archives where the evidence is locked up for 75 years. So then he gets us into another subject, and now this is where we swing to provocateurs. I brought up the subject of Richard Nixon's involvement in the assassination, and that offended Representative Talcott. He was taken back. He said, May, you have offended me, and you have offended 200 million Americans. And I said, well, Mr. Talcott, it's very important for you to know that I can't get on the American Broadcasting, Columbia Broadcasting. I'm not on the David Frost Show. I'm in Carmel at KLRB, but I'm not on the national media because they wouldn't handle this information. Not that it isn't true, but that we can't get to the people. And the 200 million people that I would offend would agree with me if they knew the facts. They'd rise up and want to know it was in the archives if we could reach them. And I pointed out a book by Penn Jones, Jr. called Forgive My Grief, in which, on page 85, this is volume 3 of Forgive My Grief, in which he describes the meeting that was held at the home of Mr. Murchison in Texas. And we've read this on another show before, where there was a conference with Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover in the Murchison home.
Explain who Murchison is.
He's a wealthy oil man in Dallas, Texas. And the night before the assassination, November 21st, 1963, there was a meeting in the garden of Mr. Murchison. And Penn Jones said, this is in quotes, when it was realized that the assassination of President Kennedy was more important than the Normandy invasion with General Eisenhower in command, the conference for the Dallas Project became essential, and the killing of President Kennedy was the most important takeover of a country in our world history, and all the major forces in this country were involved and had to be accounted for at the final conference before the strike. So a conference was necessary, and a conference was held. Since Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were in the Murchison home that night, we feel that we should report that the conference was held in that home, and J. Edgar Hoover, the task force commander, was present to confer with all his troops and to issue last-minute instructions to review the final plan and give the word whether to go or cancel as necessary, end quote. Now, Esquire magazine this month in March has a quiz on Richard Nixon. Do you know Richard Nixon? And there's a true and false section on page 125. And one of the questions, it goes down the line, does he have an ugly scar and wear glasses? President smokes cigars. The president was once a janitor. Then the 14th question on the true and false is, the president was in Dallas the day JFK was shot. And Mr. Talcott, Representative Talcott, said, was he in Dallas? And he didn't know that. Well, there were about 50 things that passed between our dialogue that Representative Talcott did not know about. And the important thing was that he could learn if he wanted to. And I gave him a book on facts about the John Kennedy assassination. He said, it's too heavy. It's too big. I said, well, you can learn something. You're supposed to learn. And he got really angry and said, I learn something every day. But we're talking about the overthrow of the government. So if I offended him on the Nixon thing, I showed him the section of the Penn Jones book and pointed out that there were a lot of things he didn't know. Now, he got concerned, and he said, well, why don't you get off the subject about political assassinations? He said, why don't you get into the Angela Davis trial? Because there was a conspiracy if I ever saw one.
Wait, repeat that.
He said, why don't you get into the subject of the Angela Davis trial if you want to go into conspiracies, because there's a conspiracy if I ever saw one. That it lends itself, or it should be studied. He implied that it certainly looks like a conspiracy there. Why don't you concern yourself with that kind of a conspiracy? So I said to him, the Angela Davis trial is interesting in terms of a conspiracy, particularly since the allegations of Lewis Tackwood. And Mr. Talcott said, who is Lewis Tackwood? And I said, he didn't know who the man was. Now, here's the representative from the state of California in Washington. And Lewis Tackwood is a provocateur in Los Angeles. So we're going to go on to provocateurs, because Lewis Tackwood is a man who worked for the Los Angeles Police Department, who claimed that the Los Angeles Police Department, the Criminal Conspiracy Section, CCS, had prior knowledge of both last year's Marin County Courthouse kidnap escape attempt and also George Jackson's fatal escape attempt from San Quentin Prison, and he allowed them to proceed despite a certainty that lives would be lost. Now, Lewis Tackwood has mentioned the man, a Daniel Mahoney of CCS Conspiracy Section, and Edward Birch of the FBI, and these men had knowledge. He says the CCS sent him up to the Bay Area to infiltrate the Angela Davis Defense Committee and the Black Caucus, and he cooperated with other police agents to suppress evidence regarding the Marin courthouse shooting. He said the police knew in advance of the escape attempt and the plans for the George Jackson escape, and he heard Sergeant Daniel Mahoney say that George Jackson will never live to go on trial. Now, I say there was a conspiracy in the Angela Davis trial, just like there was in the John Kennedy, the Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy murders. This pistol that George Jackson had in his hair, that was planted. I'm sure that Brigham, the attorney, was killed. He's never been found to prove that he didn't bring the gun. They planned to kill George Jackson in Soledad long ago. That was the origin of the original shootout, but they did get him up there, and there is a conspiracy. He's right, but our representative has in his mind a communist conspiracy or conspiracy of the blacks to kill this particular judge and do the things they're doing. And he would not let me explain how the Jackson or the Angela Davis fit in with the national conspiracy, which they do. Now, the Lewis Tackwood is a man who came forward in October, and there have been many articles about him since, and Representative Talcott should have known what he was saying, because what he says affects the whole state of California and the country. Lewis Tackwood is what he refers to himself, a criminal by choice and a police informer. Crimes, he said, are always a part of the game. He likes them. He plays them like he plays chess. Now, he made various allegations which have not been disproven at all, and it's been since October. The L.A. Police Department won't touch them, and I'm going to read what they are. He claims that two of the Los Angeles Police Department's elite units, the Criminal Conspiracy Section, CCS, and the Special Investigation Section, are guilty of dirty, murderous doings against the militants, black and white. Now, we had this in the Special Enforcement Bureau, the group of the Sheriff's Department down there that was responsible for the Manson, what they refer to the Manson case, the massacres in Los Angeles. They knew Manson was going to kill. They didn't arrest him. They were in charge of the brutality of Isla Vista. These special TAC forces are a political branch of the federal government. They're not part of the local police department. They're a political branch. And Tagwood claims that they murder the blacks and whites, and they're involved in all kinds of tricks. Tagwood claims that the SIS funneled money and arms through him, that he gave to Ron Karenga, who was the head of an organization called U.S., with the understanding that those weapons were to be used to kill Black Panthers. Tagwood said that the SIS officer's instructions made the controversial anonymous phone call in 1965 that guns were in the Black Muslim mosque, and they weren't. He claimed that Melvin Smith, the main witness in the trial of the 13 Black Panthers recently, was always a police informer and an agent provocateur, that he didn't turn state's evidence when they were arrested, that he was always in on that. Now, the reason Tagwood surfaced as a provocateur was that CCS and the FBI organized a special squad called Squad 19, and their entire job is to provoke violence in 1972 at the San Diego Convention. And that will be blamed on the leftists, and the object is to create a situation that will allow the president to invoke special emergency powers, leading to the arrest and detention of political activists. He said the CCS sent him to San Francisco Bay Area to work undercover for the FBI and the California Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation and to spy on militants and infiltrate the Black Caucus and the Berkeley City Council. Now, this is really important because it shows that these TAC squads go all over the entire state. The L.A. Police Department has foreknowledge of the plans up at Marin of Soledad. There is a national network conspiracy, and there's a statewide that links to the national. And the people who object to assassinations or the repressions that follow political assassinations and become politically active are enemies of the state. I brought in a little book, a biography, the political biography of Angela Davis, of her childhood in Birmingham, Alabama, and she was close to the family of where these four little girls were killed and bombed, and she saw the police department get off. And it's the story of her life, how she studied French and went to Sorbonne in Paris, and then she studied the Algerian police and how they killed anybody when Algeria wanted their freedom, how the police did the killing and held back the people that just wanted to run their own lives and run their own government. And it goes into her life at UCLA, where blacks were killed on campus by the police department. And she saw that was no different than Birmingham, Alabama. And it tells how she got involved in her work, and she chose the way out to be a member of the Communist Party because she felt that Governor Reagan and Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew were faces of the police state. And then she goes into how they have to come down on her when she exposes the police killings. You see, in the South, she sees that the policemen do these killings, and everyone knew who killed those little girls, and they're not arrested. And then she sees it happening in Algeria, and then she sees at UCLA, the blacks were shot on campus, and the people who shoot them get off. And what forces her to become a radical and a communist is that the police are killing. And Tagwood is saying the police are killing, and they have foreknowledge of the killings. So you're forced in a position of being a moderate, which I still am, or radical in a sense. I am not a member of the Communist Party, but she was driven to that because she saw that in our system, the killers are protected, like Officer Woolley up in San Jose. It just goes on continuously, that they can plant evidence and kill. Tagwood goes on to the charges. The two black Berkeley City Council corroborated his claim that he had worked with them, and he told them he was an undercover agent. And it was true. A motel manager said that Tagwood stayed with two white men, two units, agents, that were up there spying on militants in the North. And it's been verified that Tagwood let them use his name to put a defendant on death row. Now, you see, these are the things that a representative should go into because they affect the whole justice system of our state if Tagwood is right. And yet Representative Talcott didn't even know who Tagwood was. And checking up on what Tagwood was saying, it seems the things he was saying were true. And he went into a lot of details on that San Diego plan. Now, what has the L.A. Police Department done? Well, what do you think they have done? The L.A. Police Chief, Edward Davis, refused to allow any men from his special conspiracy section, or SIS, to be questioned by anybody. He said, we'll investigate the matter. But he said, there has to be a Bolshevik working in this to plan a story like this. He says, for 2 weeks, somebody's planning a story about the President of the United States
being tied up with the L.A. Police Department, and it has to be a Bolshevik.
let's continue with that idea after we...